This is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll remember the man who created Crosses for Losses. His work often appeared after mass shootings where he would travel and place makeshift memorials at sites across the country. COVID-19 has created problems for teachers, but also for school nurses. Without face-to-face interaction, they're concerned about what they can't see. And a lot of people are taking antibody tests to see if they've been exposed to the coronavirus.
Just because you do have antibodies doesn't mean you're free to go and do whatever you want without masks and visit people. It's most likely that you are immune or you less likely chance of developing COVID-19 again. But you have to take in consideration the false positive rate.
A reporter and her boyfriend took tests with surprising results. We'll hear more about that. Those stories and more coming up on this week's Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll remember the founder of Crosses for Losses. The Aurora man died this week after a battle with cancer. He spent years traveling to the sites of mass shootings and putting up memorials. Rural school districts especially face challenges when it comes to remote learning. We'll find out how they're handling it. And students who are visually impaired might be falling further behind other students. That and more this hour on Statewide. Over the past few weeks, companies have been offering tests they say can point out if you've been infected with COVID-19 and recovered. But there are concerns about the reliability, and that raises the question, what can those tests tell us? From member station WBEZ in Chicago, Kate McGee has this report.
When Michael Belasia learned a health clinic near his Lakeview apartment was going to start offering something called an antibody test, he decided to sign up. He had gotten sick in early March and wondered if it was a cold or COVID-19.
I think that a lot of people out there, like me, got sick at some point this year, but, not bad enough to go to the hospital for what could have very easily been just a cough or a flu, but also might have been coronavirus.
If you've had COVID-19 and survived, your body should have produced antibodies that fight off the disease. The antibody tests look for evidence of that in your bloodstream. Ultimately, these tests could help us figure out who may now be immune and who could possibly return to work, or who could donate plasma to sick patients. But Michael had also read the news about whether all the tests are reliable and the high rate of inaccurate results, which has given scientists and some government officials pause.
So I'm taking it all with a grain of salt, but I would just like to know. My girlfriend is going to be taking it as well, so we will have two tests. That way, if we both get positive results or we both get negative results, I'll trust them a little more than if we get differing results.
Who's this girlfriend you're talking about?
Her name is Kate McGee. She's on the radio.
Yep, that's me. Michael's my boyfriend. I also got sick in mid-March, either from Michael or from traveling home to New York. I never had a fever, so I assumed it wasn't coronavirus. But as I heard about more people testing positive without a fever, I wondered what if it was. On Monday, I drove to Innovative Express Care on Fullerton and Ashland to get my own antibody test. When I arrived, I met a staff member in full protective gear under a bright orange tent in the parking lot. She took my information and handed me a new mask.
All right, you can go back in your car. We're going to get you checked in, and then the medical assistant and provider will go up to your car, okay?
Thank you.
I waited back in my car for the medical assistant, who checked my temperature.
All right, let me start with middle finger, right hand. And lower your mask for me. This is going to go under your tongue. Close your mouth.
Then a doctor came back to my car, handed me paperwork to bring inside the clinic, where I would get my blood drawn for the test. Walking in. I was taken to a small exam room where I had my blood drawn.
So nothing right away.
Right, please. It was done within minutes.
How many of these have you done today?
Probably over 10 so far.
It's early. On Monday, they tested about 350 people.
Are you all set?
Great. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
You too. Stay safe.
That's right. You too.
My blood was sent to a lab for testing. As my boyfriend Michael was driving home from his test last Friday, he heard Governor J.B. Pritzker on the radio raising concerns about antibody tests and saying he had no plans to scale up this testing statewide.
What I won't do is run full speed ahead with these tests before they're proven, because, among other things, we would be offering people a false sense of security.
Some scientists also have concerns. A group of researchers tested 14 different antibody tests and found only 3 were consistently reliable. 3 out of 14. And even if you do have antibodies in your blood, it's unclear how long you're immune. The World Health Organization said right now there's no proof you can't become infected again. With all that, experts caution against using antibody tests now to make major public health decisions.
Just because you do have antibodies doesn't mean you're free to go and do whatever you want without masks and visit people, because we don't really know exactly what that means.
That's Dr. Rahul Kare, who runs the health clinic where I got my test.
It's most likely that you are immune, or you less likely chance of developing COVID-19 again. But you have to take in consideration the false positive rate.
Kare knows there are accuracy concerns, but feels confident in the test they're providing. He thinks it's worth offering antibody tests because gathering information now could end up being useful in the future. After all, scientists are learning about COVID-19 in real time. Successful, reliable antibody tests could eventually tell us how widespread infections are and who might be immune and could return to work. A few days after taking the test, we got our results. Michael got a voicemail saying he tested negative.
This means that you have not yet built up immunity to this virus, so we recommend to continue social distancing.
I got a different call.
You tested positive for IgG antibodies for COVID-19.
This was shocking to both of us.
The idea that you could get this virus from somebody at the grocery store, but not get it from living with someone who has it in 750 square feet is just so crazy to me. I feel now more than ever, maybe we just don't know anything about this virus. Like, that's crazy.
Or maybe these tests are not good.
Maybe. I don't know.
I reached out to a bunch of experts to ask what this could all mean. Dr. Elizabeth McNally at Northwestern University says it is possible I could have had coronavirus and not spread it to someone I live with, though more research needs to be done about this. And we shouldn't take that to mean this is not a highly contagious virus. It very much is. She says everyone's immune system is so different, too, which could explain varying test results. She says antibody tests are still important to track and study.
Right now, it's just been happening so quickly that I actually worry at this point that we are throwing the baby out with the bathwater and suggesting that all of them are bad, when in fact some of them are bad and they are technically bad. And a lot of them are giving variable results for really true, actual medical reasons.
As for me and Michael, we can never really know what our test results mean. So we aren't changing anything about our day-to-day lives. We're still staying inside, wearing our masks, washing our hands, and hoping this is all over as quickly as it can be. Kate McGee, WBEZ News.
Educators in Illinois expect their students to be a little behind when in-person classes eventually resume, but advocates and parents of visually impaired students fear they'll be worse off than their sighted peers. The Illinois Newsroom's education reporter Lee Gaines tells us that's because many of those students received little Braille instruction even before the coronavirus pandemic began.
Carlton Cookwalker says she's heard from many families who are struggling to keep their children learning.
In many cases, students don't have the tools they need at home to do their schoolwork. Blind students need different equipment. A pencil and paper is not necessarily going to cut it.
Cook Walker is the president of the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children. She says blind students need things like a Braille typewriter, hard copy Braille worksheets, a computer with a refreshable Braille display, and screen reading software. Ethan Edwards has all of those things at home. He's a 17-year-old student at University High School on the Illinois State University campus in Normal. Edwards is almost completely blind. Here he is using the screen reading software on his phone.
I just got to have some bragging rights here. This is how fast I normally listen to it. So here we go.
Wow, and you can understand that?
Yep.
Edwards can understand 700 words per minute. He likes getting information from audio sources, but he says Braille is still a crucial tool for him. It's how he reads and how he does math. He started receiving daily Braille instruction when he was 3 years old. But Cookwalker says Edwards is an exception, not the norm.
A lot of Braille students are lucky to get an hour a day of Braille instruction. Many only get maybe half an hour a week.
If a student doesn't already know how to read Braille, learning remotely is especially difficult. That's the situation Amber McKegg and her son Darren are in. They live in Mercer County, a rural area on the Iowa-Illinois border. Darren is about to turn 10. He has a condition that means his vision is steadily deteriorating. And even though he's in the fourth grade, Darren can't read Braille. McKegg says that's because Darren hasn't received what he needs.
Students need 1 to 2 hours a day in Braille instruction in order to learn it, and not many of them are getting that.
McKegg says Darren typically receives only an hour per week of instruction from a traveling teacher for blind and visually impaired students. Darren's Braille teacher, Kristen Schumann, is employed by the state as what's called a vision itinerant. She serves visually impaired students in the northwestern part of the state.
There is an extreme shortage of vision itinerants. I've had this job for 3 years. The one I had before this, I had for 10 years. And when I left there, they did not find a replacement for me. And as far as I know, they still do not have a teacher.
Because of the COVID-19 pandemic, Schumann is not seeing her students. But she says even in the best of times, they're not getting the instruction they need.
I can make the difference between a tax-paying citizen and a burden to society. The more literate they are, the greater their chances are of becoming a tax-paying citizen.
Schumann says it pains her to think about students going without her services. But Carlton Cookwalker with the National Organization of Parents of Blind Children says she sees an opportunity for a reset, both for parents and schools.
This environment in which we live provides us a jolt, I think, that may help us feel empowered and desirous of moving forward in a new direction.
Cookwalker says her organization is helping parents get technological resources for their kids. And for families of students like Darren who aren't reading Braille yet, she hopes this is a time where they can put together an action plan so that when school does resume, they can advocate for what they need. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
In recent weeks, we've been seeing more protests in Illinois and other parts of the country over the stay-at-home orders. Many of those attending want to see life return to some sort of normalcy and reopen the economy. But also present at certain events have been those spreading messages of hate. David Goldenberg is the Anti-Defamation League's Midwest Regional Director. His organization tracks extremist groups, and he says some signs that appeared at rallies in Chicago and Springfield recently featured swastikas, another language associated with the Nazi Party. Goldenberg talked with our Maureen McKinney.
Yeah, and for example, we've seen members of the Three Percenters, which is a wing of the anti-government movement. We've seen that they've attended events here in Illinois and other Midwestern states. Other groups like the violence-prone Proud Boys have appeared in Western states, including California. Other trends that we're seeing at the rallies include signs referencing anti-vaccine beliefs and the QAnon conspiracies. But attendees are flashing the OK hand gesture, which we know can have white supremacist connotations, and others decrying the tyrannical actions of state governments. We've seen swastikas, German sayings, you know, work will set you free, signs that have appeared at protests, which these same signs are on the outside of Auschwitz and other concentration camps. This is really quite concerning. And so we have to recognize that even in the cases where these rallies aren't necessarily being planned by an extremist or extremist organizations, they're using them as opportunities for organizing and to voice and spread their hate.
I know in Springfield, for instance, we had a sign saying Heil JB with swastikas on them. I guess they're particularly upsetting since the governor happens to be Jewish. Could it be people are so young? Could it be that they are, you know, misusing the Heil Hitler reference as just meaning any somebody who acts like a dictator, or is there a definitely anti-Semitic feeling there?
The proliferation of anti-Semitism broadly feeds into this, where we've seen dramatic increases in recent years in anti-Semitic incidents across Illinois. I mean, in the Midwest, between 2016 and 2018, we saw 110% increase in anti-Semitic incidents. And so when you see numbers like that and you experience numbers like that, and then you start seeing these types of signs with Nazi references and swastikas, which is a clear hate symbol. And either it's concerning that people don't realize the hatefulness behind these messages, or in the event that they do know exactly what these messages mean and they're being very intentful, it's quite concerning. You know, you have a democratically elected governor who happens to be Jewish, and you're using Nazi references to attack him or compare him to Hitler. I mean, it is offensive, and it has no place in Illinois. We can all agree that while we may have differences in opinion on the stay-at-home order, and this is an order that is intended to keep people safe and healthy and to get our economy going again, there are ways to protest peacefully that don't involve these types of hateful and rhetorical messages, that don't involve semi-automatic weapons that are intended to intimidate and scare. And so we're concerned about that.
And is there anything that can be done about it besides education? And maybe that's the most important thing, though.
There's no question about it. Education is a key element toward addressing ignorance that could exist. Ignorance of not understanding, you know, the true depth of the hate of these hateful messages. But also, you know, leaders have to avoid using inflammatory language that perpetuates these hateful ideas. And they create such tension and angst within the community that things can spill over from online to real life presence to harassment, vandalism, and assault.
David Goldenberg is the Midwest Regional Director for the Anti-Defamation League, and he spoke with Maureen McKinney. We're glad you're with us here on Statewide. There's more ahead. Stick around. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, while schools are closed, students are missing out on more than just face-to-face time with teachers. They also might be missing an important link in their access to health care, school nurses. And we'll hear from some comedians still making audiences laugh remotely. That and more still to come. This week, Governor J.B. Pritzker announced a regional plan to eventually reopen the state, but our Bill Wheelhouse reports it may be a while before large events can take place anywhere.
The governor breaks the state up into four sections. Each part of the state will be monitored for improvement in health metrics and would be classified at one of five stages. The state is currently at level two with a slightly relaxed stay-at-home order. If regions show improvement, hair salons and retail outlets could open.
And I won't open the door to overwhelming our hospital system just because a loud but tiny minority would like to indulge in that fantasy.
Later phases in the governor's plan would allow schools and colleges to open up, but the final stage, which would allow for stadiums full of people, would require a vaccine or better medical treatment for COVID-19. I'm Bill Wheelhouse.
It's planting season across much of the U.S., and some farmers who rely on foreign guest workers are having to look elsewhere for help due to the coronavirus pandemic. For Harvest Public Media, Dana Cronin has this report.
Usually this time of year, Pete Pistorius would be hosting a crew from South Africa on his farm.
Just as anything else in our lives, the pandemic has changed kind of the way we've dealt with our H-2A process or our labor force.
Pistorius helps run a corn and soybean operation in central Illinois. And for the last few years, he's gotten help on the farm through the H-2A visa program. It allows farmers to bring over foreign nationals to fill temporary agricultural jobs.
Our plan was to be able to get three guys over here. And I think the start date we'd requested was like the 25th of March.
March 25th came and went, and still his team from South Africa couldn't make it over because of the lockdown order there.
You know, we're kind of stuck in this limbo situation of we really don't know when they'll be over or whether they'll even make it here for this year's planting season.
That's one of the busiest times on the farm, and Pistorius really relies on those guest workers for help. Other farmers who bring in workers from countries like Guatemala, Honduras, and Nepal, all on lockdown, are facing similar situations.
You know, your first reaction is, you know, what are you going to do?
Then it hit him. There's an entire population of people without work due to the pandemic in his community alone. People like Derek Brown. He worked full-time at the local school district in the maintenance department, doing everything from cleaning to mowing. When his school closed, Brown says they called him in to help sanitize the place, but then that was it. He was no longer needed.
We're at a standstill right now. I mean, when you don't have any kids at school, you know, the kids aren't, you know, getting the school dirty.
Brown used to work at Pistorius Farms and says he's happy to come back and help out.
It's a busy time of year for him. And, you know, so not getting those South Africans, it's kind of helping him out with the situation.
This kind of partnership is playing out in other states, too. In Arkansas, Congressman Rick Crawford launched a program that connects farmers to those out of a job, citing the lack of H-2A workers in the state.
These are people that didn't have jobs that now do. And these are farmers who needed people on their farms. Now they have them.
Derek Brown says there's no comparison between work on the farm and his job at the school.
I mean, I enjoy it. I really do. Farming is not easy work.
That's because in addition to sheer manual labor, farming can require a lot of technical skills, like knowing how to operate a tractor or a combine. Each person Pete Pistorius had hired through the H-2A program had specific training and experience. Now, in addition to Derek Brown, his crew includes a laid-off commercial plumber and a few high school students.
It's going to make us be better at training, maybe be a little more patient, spending time with these people to make sure that they can safely operate the equipment.
Pistorius says training is inherent to the job, but usually he'll train someone who stays on the farm anywhere from 6 months to 6 years.
The unfortunate part is that you're training for a part-time job, and you know these people will eventually go back to their regular jobs.
Once schools reopen, Derek Brown will leave the farm and go back to his regular job, and there's a chance that'll happen before it's time to harvest.
We're just trying to get the crop in to start out with, and you know, just kind of trying to take it one battle at a time.
After all, Pistorius says, he's been farming for 22 years, and so far he's always managed to get the crop in and out. Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
The stay-at-home order means a lot fewer drivers are on the road, and that means less money being spent on fuel. That reduces gas tax money for road repairs. Josh Sharp with the Illinois Petroleum Marketers Association tells us the pandemic has destroyed demand for gasoline.
The first initial probably few weeks, we saw actually a spike in demand. After that, demand's really just been obliterated by, you know, the pandemic.
Sharp says gas sales are down by at least 50% since the stay-at-home order was put in place. A continued decline in revenue could mean up to $500 million less to help pay for local and statewide road repairs in the coming year. During hard times in the past, people often found relief by attending comedy shows. But what do you do when comedy clubs are closed? And what about the comics left to find humor for themselves? Yvonne Booz tells us how some Northern Illinois comedians are making it through the pandemic.
Rudy Ruiz is a comedian from Aurora. He says he misses being on stage.
Now that we're not allowed into comedy clubs or open mic or even writing groups, it's like a withdrawal.
He says making people laugh is like a superpower and the pandemic is the enemy.
It's like kryptonite right now. It's like, you know, we can't do anything and, you know, a lot of us are going crazy.
He says he knows some comics have tried to do virtual comedy shows, but he doesn't understand that concept.
We need the audience. You know, we have that immediate response, like the joke did well.
Kimberly Marion is also from Aurora. She started doing stand-up 9 years ago. She was a teacher prior to that. She says nothing will take the place of live stand-up, but she says she can still be creative through social media.
Actually, I'm working on a cartoon currently to do some comedy. I do Instagram posts, just funny, a little levity, just so that people can laugh at something during this time.
Marion says she has a podcast called the Happy Corner Podcast that she continues to do as well. Shane Batchelor lives in DeKalb. He moved there from Atlanta a few years ago. He's done comedy for about 7 years. He says he's doing a lot of writing during this time. He says the way people are acting during this pandemic has become a source for his material.
You'll see somebody, they'll have a mask on at Walmart and then take the mask off to scratch their face or to rub their eyeball.
Batchelor speaks about other things he's observed while shopping.
There'll be a whole group of 10 people all in one big ball walking around Walmart.
Like it has for so many, the pandemic has affected their livelihood. Three of the comedians have other sources of income, but one of them relies solely on comedy. Marcos Lora of Rockford says he's done comedy for about 13 years. He's out of work because of the pandemic, and because he is a gig worker, he hasn't received unemployment yet.
Although the federal government was able to agree, and the president and Senate and Congress were all able to agree on passing the CARES Act, Illinois has not yet figured out how exactly they're going to be disbursing that money to unemployed gig workers.
He says he's not writing a lot of comedy right now, but he is writing poetry. He offers to read an example.
Here's the part that I was particularly proud of because of the wordplay and complexity in the rhyme scheme. The truth is mathematical. I'm an irrational variable. Roots rising, Toltec a cannibal. I'm the parabola of this parable.
Comedians are also leaning on each other during this time. Miriam says they are doing this digitally.
I am zoomed out. I've been a part of so many Zoom conversations or Snapchat conversations or, you know, video calls through Facebook.
Batchelor and Ruiz say they also keep in close contact with their fellow comics. The comedians want to extend that encouragement to everyone. Ruiz says, despite the pandemic, people should continue to laugh.
Find the funny out there. It's somewhere out there, even though we're going through this. Don't lose a sense of humor.
And Shane Batchelor says, don't let the negative bring you down. Find the affirmative. He says, for him, it's comedy. That's what keeps him going.
I got a day job, but the day job's just to pay the bills. Making people laugh is what makes me want to live.
And he and the others look forward to the day they can do that with a live audience. Face to face. I'm Yvonne Booz.
This is Statewide. Illinois students have been e-learning in the wake of the pandemic for more than a month now. It could continue even into the next school year. Peter Medlin takes a look at the challenges still facing rural schools.
Coronavirus has highlighted the digital divide among low-income as well as rural students. Schools that don't send students home with laptops rush them equipment so they could do their homework online. School administrators say some parents claim they have internet access, but it may only be through a phone plan. Districts have been distributing hotspots for families without a plan or where service is undependable. Particularly in rural communities like Montmorency, reliable internet connectivity is a major hurdle. Montmorency is a K-8 district in Whiteside County with around 230 students. Alex Moore is the superintendent.
On a good day, I get 4 megabytes per second download speed, so I knew that was going to be an issue. About half of our families probably have decent internet.
Even that good day download speed doesn't meet the FCC's minimum recommendation for e-learning. For many younger students, remote learning has to be paper and pencil. Schools like Samanak set up blocks of time where parents can walk into the school, grab their child's materials while maintaining social distancing. Jay Stryker is the superintendent at Samanak. He says parents come in around once every week and a half to 2 weeks.
They walk through, they see a table with their grade level, they find their kid's stuff, they pick it up, they walk out, get a squirt of hand sanitizer, and go on their way.
But these small districts do have some advantages. For one, they've both had teachers and staff reach out and talk to each family. Moore says a middle school teacher at Montmorency is delivering lunch to their 8th grade students, dropping them off a few houses per day.
You know, it gives her a chance to check in on them individually and just to, have that personal touch.
The academic aspect of e-learning is still a work in progress, and districts know it just doesn't replace the classroom experience. In Illinois, grades can't count against students during the COVID-19 crisis. And Jay Stryker in Samanak says that can sometimes lead to a lack of motivation.
Very difficult when you're dealing with high school students who interpret that a different way. And they think, well, that means I don't have to do anything.
And while students focus on finishing out this year, more and more school administrators have to consider long-term effects. If schools are still e-learning in the fall, some worry about how students will adjust to new classes and new teachers. Jay Stryker says,
one of the first things you do is build a relationship with your students And that's not going to be easy to do in Zoom. In fact, I think it'll be impossible.
He says the teachers who have established social-emotional bonds have helped students get through e-learning even when that motivation falls off.
That's what inspires these kids to learn, is knowing that these teachers care about them, not just a test score, but them as a person and helping them pursue their dreams.
Canceled spring sports and events are also disappointing for students and parents. Illinois State Superintendent Carmen Ayala recently announced that schools are not allowed to hold in-person graduations at this point. Some districts had to cancel alternative events like drive-in senior celebrations as well. In light of that news, some decided not to reschedule an in-person ceremony and just do graduation digitally. Samanak is planning an online event, but they're also holding on to hope that students could walk across the stage in some way this summer.
We at least want to have those on the calendar and, you know, try to be really positive that we're going to get to a point where we can at least have something.
In the meantime, plenty of schools, rural or not, are using social media to keep families engaged during the home stretch of at-home learning. Many are having digital spirit weeks. Stryker says they're having daily challenges like cooking or showing off pets.
You can show us a picture of your dog, that's a positive.
As of now, the Illinois State Board of Education has not made any decisions on if some form of e-learning could carry on into the next school year. I'm Peter Medlin.
Students are wrapping up the school year remotely, and as Lee Gaines with Illinois Newsroom reports, some school nurses in Illinois fear that means they won't be able to spot the warning signs of illness or abuse.
Lisa Marlowe is a school nurse in the Murfreesboro School District. The district serves mostly low-income students in a rural part of southern Illinois. When school's in session, she says having eyes on students, especially those with chronic conditions like type 1 diabetes and asthma, is crucial.
The biggest reason why it's a huge part of our job is because people don't get to access healthcare anywhere else, or won't, or don't have the means to. I have high school students who don't have insurance.
But that's not happening right now. Now, Marlowe's delivering meals to students in the district. At least that way, she can try to see her students.
We're just volunteering now. That's kind of my job. We're driving around town. We're going through the back alleys of Murfreesboro.
While on the lunch route, Marlowe recently spotted a middle schooler she knows who has a hard time managing his diabetes.
I said, hey, how you doing? And he had this kind of cast to his skin. It was kind of grayish cast to his skin that I've seen before when he was not well controlled, when he was sick.
Marlowe says he didn't want to talk to her, so she called his mom, and his mom told her he was fine. But Marlowe says she worries parents might miss something that she'd pick up on. That's something parent Rebecca Strait agrees with.
These people are important and they're essential in my kids' lives.
Strait adopted her children from the foster care system. Two of Strait's children have feeding tubes and tracheostomies because they suffer from severe lung disease. Normally, they have one-on-one nurses who attend school with them. Her third child, Jariah, who's 11, would see her school nurse every day. Jariah has a severe form of asthma.
So, you know, like she will check her vitals, she'll listen to her heart and stuff like that, which is very important for a child with asthma. And so with us being home, she doesn't get that.
Strait's family lives in a rural part of central Illinois, about 45 minutes from Springfield. She says she takes notes from all the nurses her children see at school and gives them to their multitude of doctors, none of whom they're seeing right now because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Sanjay Bansal values that kind of insight from school nurses. Dr. Bansal treats children with diabetes at the Loyola University Medical Center near Chicago.
The school nurses are more than just observers and data recorders. Often they are the lifeline to making sure that these children are not severely sick.
Now that school nurses aren't seeing kids on a daily basis, Dr. Bansal says he worries the most about children without good parental supervision. Strait worries about that, too. Before she adopted Jariah, a school nurse alerted authorities she was being neglected. Later, Jariah almost died after she suffered an asthma attack.
She came home from school. There was no parents at home, and she had an asthma attack. And she was found by a friend that came over to her house.
Jariah was in a coma for 2 months and in a hospital for 4 months.
And so, yes, that nurse is very important to these kids. So I worry about that population myself.
Strait says her daughter, Jariah, is fearful that something like that will happen to her again. But she trusts her school nurse and relies on her for a sense of comfort and safety. School nurses are often the first people to spot warning signs of illness and abuse. But that's a challenge when schools are closed. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Ahead, we'll remember the founder of Crosses for Losses. Stay with us. There's more of Statewide to come. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This week saw the passing of Greg Zanis, who became known as the Cross Man. He would travel across the country to place memorials after a mass shooting. Zanis was from Aurora. For over 23 years, he personally built and delivered more than 27,000 crosses. On Statewide this week, we look back at Greg Zanis' life and listen to an interview Brian O'Keefe conducted with him earlier this year.
For most of his life, Greg Zanis was a resource for homeowners hoping to spruce up a kitchen, basement, or bath. His carpentry skills would come to dominate his life, even after he retired from remodeling. Zanis made and took 58 crosses to Las Vegas after the 2017 mass shooting. He took 49 more to Orlando after the Pulse nightclub shooting, and 6 more just down the road from his home after last February's factory shooting in Aurora. He also took crosses to Paradise, California after wildfires swept through, and to communities that found themselves in the crosshairs of tornadoes, hurricanes, and floods. Zanis has created thousands of memorials, but Crosses for Losses started on a much smaller scale. In 1996, Zanis found his father-in-law, Ralph Stadler, shot to death at the bottom of a stairwell in Aurora.
It was not something I expected. You know, he was my best friend for 25 years. He had taught me how to become a carpenter. But then I joined a support group at my wife's church, a Catholic church down the street here. And a lady came in and had just lost her son that day, a 6-year-old Nico Contreras. She came to the support group. She knew it was down there. She said, would I build a cross for her son? And she would pay me $20. And I said, well, no, I wouldn't charge, but I was back within an hour and a half or so, you know, and put my first cross in that day. And immediately people started responding to this. And, you know, I had it in around noon. And at about 8 o'clock at night, there was a crowd of 300 or 400 or 500 people just silently there. And the father was screaming, you know, why? But the peace that cross brought, I immediately realized right that minute that this is what I'm going to do for the rest of the people in the support group. So not to be complicated, the 15th cross, which was within a week, was from my father-in-law. It just gave me comfort, myself. And immediately, within a few years, I'd put up 250 or so crosses.
He continued to make the memorials for victims on and off during 1997 and 1998. But the aftermath of April 20th, 1999, would elevate the profile of Zanis's crosses for losses.
I was invited to Columbine, and I was asked to bring 15 crosses down, and it offended a lot of people that I put crosses up for the two gunmen, a whole lot. So it was complicated. I went down there, removed the scene. I just felt I was hurting people. Then and I got back to Illinois. People were begging me to put them back up again, and I ended up going back and forth to Denver 5 times in 30 days. Very complicated, you know. I put them up, the government took them down, a private individual gave me an acre. I went and put another set up, came back, and then Chapel Hill Memorial gave me 35 lots in a cemetery to put up the crosses again, which eventually becomes a granite permanent memorial. Very, very complicated, but very easy. And from that day on, I went and toured these Columbine crosses to 500 cities with every parent of Columbine. I was inviting them to be the keynote speakers. I never spoke at any events. And then I kind of laid it down. I said, you know, this is too much. So I quit the touring, I guess that's what you call it. And then Red Lake, Minnesota happened in 2003. This is several years later. So I went up to the Indian Reservation and put them up there. But in the meantime, I'd constantly increased the number from a few hundred to several thousand immediately. I was in every state, and I always carried extra crosses.
Zanis also made crosses for each of the victims of the mass shootings at Virginia Tech University, Northern Illinois University, and Sandy Hook Elementary School. Typically, he arrives, places the memorials, and leaves as quickly as possible.
But I saw this as a mission, a calling. I really don't accept awards or certificates or honors. I've been asked to do all of those. I've been asked by unbelievable people to come and, you know, all the presidents have tried to get a piece of me. You know, I don't give that any credit, you know. I mean, I voided Trump twice at the temple, you know, was asked to stay in Alabama where there was a tornado, I was asked to stay to meet him. And I tell him, I'll be there, but I'm really already home by then. I'm not looking for any self-gratification. I'm doing this for, you know who I'm doing it for the victims, that they have a way that they can be, their family member can be remembered. If I stayed for 3 days, it'll all be about Greg Zanis.
But he has made a few exceptions. Zanis made a rare and deliberate public comment after the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando.
When I went to Orlando and put up the crosses, people in my town, they were very upset that I was going to go do this. Very upset. Is that the church community? All the more reason. I'm thinking, this is all the more reason. I was told not to come back. I just felt, and making 49 crosses was a lot of work, too. And, you know, by then I had started adding the hearts to them. But when I went down there, I decided, and I rarely interview, that I'm going to do this. I'm going to say, love your neighbor, love your brother, and don't judge him. So on the way in town, I was listening to a radio station in Orlando and two pastors and a rabbi, and they were just bashing gay people. But on the way out of town, those same three people realized, they said, Greg Zanis made it clear. You know, we're hating. Immediately, I brought a calming down to a city that was really anti-gay. And I realized, wow, the power here, you know. And I scheduled a prayer vigil, but I didn't go to it. I do that a lot, you know. But since then, I was putting up, you know, thousands of crosses a year immediately. And it was just like nonstop.
The Aurora man has no doubt his crosses for losses have made a difference.
I've seen America's heart change. Because I've been to all of the different ones, like I went to the temple in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where 11 Jewish people were murdered. I went to the Shiite temple in Milwaukee, were a different faith. I went to, you know, the gay nightclub in Puerto Ricans. I went to Las Vegas, where it was a country music festival. And immediately when I put crosses in a grouping, whether it's Nashville at the Waffle House, it changes everybody. First thing they do is quit talking about the gunman. That was a major goal. Talk about the victims here. When I went to Vegas, they quit talking about the gunman the second I put some names and pictures on those. And what I'm seeing is, it's not just Vegas. When that happens, you know, people from Orlando, they want to come in. People from Newtown. People from the Aurora, Colorado theater shooting. And all of a sudden, I'm making the war zones in America a family. You know, we're not letting this define us. We come out victorious every single time when we put those crosses up. And tens of thousands of people came out to Las Vegas. I cannot even begin to tell you. 24 hours a day, the crowds, and the healing that offered. And just our nation wasn't looking at the bad anymore. They're seeing how we come together.
On January 1st, Zanis officially turned the operation over to the Northbrook-based Lutheran Church Charities. It already responds to many of the same incidents with its Comfort Dog program. He says last year proved to be just too much.
I went to 41 homicide, you know, major shootings, 41. And starting the year off, it was really hard for me sitting right here. And, you know, I'm watching all these police cars go by, you know, 20, 25, 30, 35. And finally my daughter comes, you know, into the shop and says, "Dad, there's an act." I don't want to get emotional. "Dad, there's an active shooter here in Aurora." I just didn't see that coming. I can't, you know, I'm just this dumb, blindsided by this whole thing. All of a sudden, it's something I really wasn't wanting to do anymore. What really was the straw that broke the camel's back is when they went to El Paso. And I drive there, you know, it's not a two-day drive, but, you know, I made the crosses, and I hadn't slept in a couple of days. And on the way down there, you know, I'm much more famous than I realized. I had 14 family members call me before I got there. So I had confirmed names before the coroner releases the names. And then I'm there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and all of a sudden, all these family members start coming out, and they're lined up waiting for me to write their sons or daughters or relatives' name. And a lot of them didn't speak any English. And it just started to wear on me.
Zanis collapsed in El Paso, but he didn't stop. Exhausted and still feeling the effects of the heat, word came of another mass shooting, this one in Dayton. So he left South Texas and headed to Ohio.
The president had just been there and riled up the city. Believe me, there were National Guard at each end of the street. And it was getting close to dark, you know, and they said they didn't want me to go. Well, I picked up Elliot McLaughlin. He was a reporter for CNN in Illinois before I crossed over to Ohio, and he rode in with me. And it was just such a calming when my truck went down that street with those crosses on it. But when I left there, and I only stayed about an hour or 2 hours, it was an overwhelming calm that I left, you know, those crosses there. And I've seen similar before, but never like that before. It's starting to wear, you know, and I'm doing the Vegas anniversaries. And, you know, Thousand Oaks was in California, another shooting at a bar. And, you know, not to be backwards, but just before Thousand Oaks, I did the temple in Philadelphia, just a week or 11 days earlier. I didn't even have my truck unpacked. You know, I keep blankets and pillows and, you know, all the stuff. So in California, I decided, you know, I'd already decided that this is what I'm going to do. So then I started setting up states. I set up Texas. I set up Florida. And pretty soon I got a list of 26 states that want to do this with me, with the Lutheran Charities, and now that's expanded to 135. You know, that's not my list. That's mm-hmm. their list.
For 24 years, Greg Zanis has repeatedly gone to the scenes of mass shootings and from one natural disaster to another. It's clear Crosses for Losses has taken a toll on the man behind the project.
Every single time I leave a city, without exception, you know, I break down. I don't know how I made it through that, you know, pretending I'm somebody that I'm not that person. It's taken a huge personal toll on me, more than anybody can understand. I need to quit this for my own, you know, and I think it's a very mature decision to have it carry on by somebody else. So I can't even tell you how hard it's been. Can't tell anybody how one man out there looking like, you know, he can handle it, and I can't do this anymore. Last year was just too hard.
Greg Zanis speaking with Brian O'Keefe. That interview conducted earlier this year. Zanis was from Aurora and known for his effort Crosses for Losses. He died from cancer this week. Aurora's mayor, Richard Irvin, paid tribute this week. He called Zanis a giant among men and a man of action who simply wanted to honor the lives of others. Greg Zanis was 69. That's it for Statewide. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be back next week. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this episode or past episodes, you can find them all at statewideshow.com. And you can find our podcast each week through the NPR One app. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.